Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.byteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for today's show. Today is National Look Up at the Sky Day, and go outside, look up, and embrace that things are looking up feeling. And that kind of fits in with today's show, where my very special guest is Mitch Horowitz, and we are going to be talking about his newly released book called The Miracle Power of Your Mind, The Joseph Murphy Treasury. It is an unprecedented collection of rare and life-changing classics from pioneering author of The Power of Your Subconscious Mind. The newest Tarcher Success classic pulls together in one convenient and inspiring compendium some of the rarest and most extraordinary books by Mind Power Master Joseph Murphy. Today's guest, Mitch Horowitz, is a writer and publisher with a lifelong interest in man's search for meaning. The Penn Award-winning author of Occult America and One Simple Idea, Mitch has written on everything from war, the war on witches, to The Secret Life of Ronald Reagan for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Salon, and Time. The Washington Post says Mitch treats esoteric ideas and movements with an even-handed intellectual studiousness that is often lost in today's raised voice discussions. He is also the voice of popular audiobooks, including Alcoholics Anonymous and the Jefferson Bible, and host of the web series Origins Superstitions. Mitch is vice president and executive editor at Tarcher Perigee, a division of Penguin Random House. You can find out more by visiting his website, which is www.mitchhorowitz.com. And I have a direct link to his website in the show page description. Okay, everybody, we have our very special guest, Mitch Horowitz. Hello, Mitch. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to a positive, upbeat discussion today. Talking about
I'll try to deliver.
I have no doubt that you can. Let's go ahead and first start off with, come to know positive thinking as one of those things that people often talk about, and you have called it an American creed.
Yes.
Why is it that you called it that?
Well, positive thinking is in many ways an outlook that underlies so much of what goes on in our economy, our culture, our politics. The U.S. Army's famous slogan was "Be All You Can Be." Ronald Reagan's campaign slogan was "Nothing Is Impossible." Barack Obama's was "Yes, We Can." And we see, of course, the positive thinking ethos reflected in ad slogans like "Just Do It." And, of course, it affects our sense of medical care. You know, we're told, I think with some very good reason, that having a support group, having confidence in your treatment, and so on and so forth, can play a positive role in recovery. And there are many, many studies that bear out those things. But more significantly, I would say that all of us, both mainstream folk and more New Age folk, and I would put myself in the New Age category, should take a second look at positive thinking, because it's easy to overlook as this overly familiar philosophy that we think belongs to refrigerator magnets and page day calendars, just dispensing little bromides about having a nice day with a smiley face. And those kinds of familiar expressions can conceal a great deal of depth. It's a radical philosophy that brings metaphysics into daily life, and I'm persuaded of its effectiveness. There's also a lot of mystery around it, but I would encourage everyone to take a long, deep second look at what we call positive thinking. It's easy to take it for granted, but there's a lot there.
Yeah. Now, as an American creed, do you find that as Americans we kind of tend to take that or try for that positive outlook more than other people around the globe?
Well, that's a good question. I guess I describe it as an American creed because it started here in America. What we call the power of positive thinking has its roots in what was called the mental healing movement, beginning in New England in the mid-19th century. And although the mental healers were dealing with ideas that had crossed over to America from Europe, especially mesmerism, which we later came to call hypnotism, they were breaking new religious and psychological ground by experimenting with the causative powers of the mind. In their case, back in the mid-19th century, they were chiefly concerned with bodily healing. But later, in America, this idea expanded to include finance and relationships and so forth. And so it's uniquely American in its roots. And it has spread in America more than any other nation. In fact, it's become one of America's primary exports to the world as ideas go. Many new spiritual ideas, ranging from spiritualism or talking to the dead to new religions like Mormonism, Seventh-day Adventism, Christian Science, were born on American soil. We seem to be very good at exporting religions to the rest of the world. So I wouldn't describe positive thinking as explicitly or strictly American, but it certainly began here, and it's entered the groundwater of our country more fully, certainly, than any other nation. There is something uniquely American about the notion that thoughts are causative, that your attitude can do more than make you a nicer person to be around, but that it can concretely affect things that happen to you.
Yeah. Now, you kind of mentioned the, you know, our, you know, have a nice day.
we sometimes
kind of say just like an automatic, you know. So do you know that in a way, you know, particularly if someone says it and you know that there really isn't sincerity behind that, do you think that
yeah.
maybe adds to some of the perception that it's really shallow or that it really doesn't have meaning?
Yes, I do. You know, I think anything that we start to use or recite by rote kind of guts the original idea itself. Coffee cups with smiley faces on them are certainly not enough. And if that stuff gets put in people's faces too much, it does breed a kind of cynicism. I mean, the same thing happens with so many of our historical figures. From time to time, I think about the abolitionist activist Frederick Douglass, who struggled to end slavery in this country. You know, a figure like Douglass, we can think, well, we've heard of him, we get it, we understand. But when adults or motivated kids return to Douglass's memoirs and start to read them anew, my God, you know, the experience of slavery, it just hits you with this whole new moral force. And the appreciation of a man like that just goes beyond the parameters that we've set for him. And, you know, a lot of people and philosophies can be like that. The moment that someone becomes familiar, the moment that you start to see his face staring out at you from the $1 bill or the $5 bill, or the moment that we smack, you know, a Susan B. Anthony on a coin somewhere, a certain ordinariness starts to surround the person. We think we get it, but we don't get it. And the same thing happens with positive thinking. When we turn it into have a nice day bromides or refrigerator magnets or what have you, not that there's anything wrong with refrigerator magnets, I'm all for them, but that
right.
does start to render things in a kind of overly familiar terms, and we start thinking we get it, at which point we stop really examining the idea. So positive thinking has been positioned that way within American life, that it's almost this boring common sense, like being told to eat your vegetables. And we think, well, we get it. I understand I have to eat my vegetables. But of course, eating your vegetables could mean the difference between heart failure and health. And then it no longer seems mm-hmm. like such a joke. So something similar has happened with positive thinking. And I think we need to reclaim the radicalism behind the original idea.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the book title is the Joseph Murphy Treasury. So would you mind sharing with the listeners a little bit about who Joseph Murphy is and maybe
yes.
some of the core values behind his work?
Sure. I decided to assemble this really quite massive anthology, The Miracle Power of Your Mind, the Joseph Murphy Treasury, of his work, because I think of him as in some ways the most famous guy that you've never heard of. Joseph Murphy was a very influential exponent of the metaphysics of positive thinking. He died in 1981. He originally came to America from the southern coast of Ireland, where he was born and raised, arrived in America in the 1930s, and his training was as a chemist, so he originally ran some pharmacy counters, some drugstore counters here in New York City, where I live. And he grew deeply interested in the new metaphysics that were sweeping the Western world at that time, specifically Christian Science, Science of Mind, New Thought. All these ideas held that in one way or another, the mind was a channel of God's influence. I'm not really describing Christian Science accurately when I say that. The Christian Science ideal was that the mind, the human mind, is the seat of all illness and violence and prejudice, and that if you could cleanse the doors of perception, as it were, if that artificial mind could be dissolved so that the great one intelligence of God could shine through, there could be healing, there could be peace in the world. The other movements, Science of Mind, New Thought, Divine Science, they were possessed of a different outlook, that the mind itself was a channel of divine will, in a sense. And Murphy grew absolutely enamored of these new metaphysical philosophies and soon discovered that he was gifted at communicating these things himself, but in very, very simple ways, exquisitely simple ways. And he became a metaphysical minister, began to write pamphlets and books in this field, and he broke through the national attention in 1963 with a book called The Power of Your Subconscious Mind, a book that some of your listeners probably know. And that book, probably more than any other, expressed Murphy's philosophy that the mind that we don't use for creating shopping lists or doing the ordinary work of life, the subconscious mind, which can be reached at times of great relaxation, meditation, prayer, visualization, that deeper mind was a channel of higher power. And that through properly utilizing that mind, directing our thoughts, using affirmation, prayer, visualization, and so forth, we could bring things into our world and fix things in our world that needed fixing. That was his challenge. And he would state this in such simple terms and offer such exquisitely simple techniques that it was a challenge that any working person with a quick lunch hour to spare or a few minutes before going to sleep at night could try, could test, could challenge. And I thought there was such a beauty to the man's simplicity. His life was a simple life. He didn't have any great business apparatus at his back like many of the motivational teachers today. He wrote his pamphlets, he wrote his books, he traveled around the country speaking at metaphysical churches or meeting halls, auditoriums, wherever he was invited, and he would make a living off of his speaking fees or contributions that people might give him at a church. He would sell his books, sell his pamphlets, and he was really a kind of traveling salesman for the metaphysical. He was a barnstormer. He would just travel the country, do his thing, and he was able to retire quite well. He made a good living. He maintained an incredible output of books and speaking. And he died in Laguna Hills, California, as I mentioned, in 1981. He lived a good life, but it was a simple life. As daring as his ideas were, as bold and audacious as his titles were, he used to call his books things like Riches Are Your Right or Your Infinite Power to Be Rich. For all that boldness, he was a simple guy, a sincere guy, who believed in using bold language to reach people. He wanted to reach people where they lived. And so I felt it was time to assemble many of his most influential writings in one place, and that's how the book came about. It's a very large book, but it's also a very simple book.
Yeah, well, that's great. You know, and I love the idea of it being the new thought. You know, and this was, of course, most of the works were in the 50s. You know, so
yeah.
It's you know, we just kind of sit back and, you know, today what, you know, a lot of people talk as new thought, you know, recognizing, but, you know, this gentleman, you know, addressed 60 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and it's yeah. And you know, one of the pieces in that anthology you have is How to Attract Money, like 1955.
Yes.
And you
yeah.
know, and here we have the power of, you know, the law of attraction and all that kind of stuff was had its
yeah.
day, you know, heyday. And it's like, well, wait a minute, you know, that goes way back.
Yes, it sure does. And Murphy was a pioneer, you know, along with someone like Norman Vincent Peale, who wrote The Power of Positive Thinking. I mean, Peale became a household name. Murphy did not. But those were his contemporaries, and he was really helping to lay down the foundation of this whole philosophy.
Yeah. Now, you know, as a metaphysical minister, I noticed several of the titles in the anthology have connections to religious writings. Like, for example, you know, the meaning of the Book of John in one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
healings of Jesus and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, was as you went through and, you know, read these pieces, how would you describe his perspective of metaphysics and religion?
That is a wonderful question, and you're one of the only people I've spoken to who noticed that many of Murphy's early works were analyses of scriptural books, particularly books from the New Testament. If you asked Murphy, "Are you a Christian?" I suspect he would have said, "Yes, I'm a Christian to the extent that I believe in the universal philosophy coming through the New Testament, but I also believe that the same philosophy can be found in the Bhagavad Gita and the Tao Te Ching and the Dhammapada and all the great religious books of the world, including Greek and Roman myth, including Egyptian metaphysical parables. They are all conveying this one message, that there is a creative power in the universe, there is a great mind, and we are tiny capillaries of that mind." He would have cited the psalm, "Ye are as gods." And so Murphy certainly took a lot of his early inspiration from the New Testament and from the Gospels. He came from a devoutly Catholic family back home in Ireland. He had considered entering the priesthood. He was planning on entering a Catholic seminary, but he changed his mind and decided instead first to strike out for some kind of career success in America, and then he came back to religion and metaphysics by way of the New Thought culture. I think what Murphy would say is that religion is legitimate, but our interpretation of it is not, that we have lost the original keys, that the New Testament and other great religious and ethical statements were parabolic stories of the power of the mind, were encouraging men and women to use this creative capacity, and that we modern people have become illiterate in understanding what Scripture is really all about. So he would say, yes, I'm a Christian, but I'm a Christian as it was originally understood at the time of primeval Christianity, before the religion got layered over with all this superfluous stuff, as he viewed it. So he was very comfortable with Christian languages and references, and as you noted, many of his early books were metaphysical analyses of New Testament books, but he believed that Christianity had lost its original way and that he was trying to help people back to it.
Yeah, you know, because as I was reading through the topics, that was one of the things that, you know, crossed my mind. It seemed, you know, particularly in the 1950s, you know, that
yeah.
it seemed that he was, you know, trying to, you know, help those, you know, along with in the Christian faith to recognize, you know, that, you know, some extended meaning, you know, behind what it is that they, you know, what they follow, and maybe try to bridge the gap between metaphysics and, you know, and Christian religion.
I think you're absolutely right. And I applaud you for that sensitive reading of his book, because it's easy for people to overlook that Murphy and some of his contemporaries, they were metaphysical ministers. They did see themselves as part of a church. Murphy proudly called himself a minister. He was ordained in the Divine Science Movement, which is one of these metaphysical positive thinking congregations with very deep roots in America. And he took that very seriously. It can be easy to forget that in later years when, you know, he was writing books called, you know, the Your Infinite Power for Richer Living, or How to Attract Money, things like that, all of which are very much in context with his earlier work, but his earlier work was more scripturally referenced. And had he continued down that path, he may have become even more famous, because Norman Vincent Peale's great innovation was to reprocess New Thought language through scripture and through language and references that the church-going public could be comfortable with. Murphy went in a more radically non-denominational direction, but you're right on. You know, his earliest roots, certainly his reference points, were Christian.
Yeah. Now, out of the 20 books and pamphlets, more than 20 books and pamphlets that you, you know, have assembled in this collection, is there any particular one that for you just struck a chord, something that, you know, really made an impression on you, you know, having been written, you know, more than 60 years ago? Anything that stuck out in your mind as being of particular interest or fascination for you?
That's a good question. In some ways, his book, The Power of Your Subconscious Mind, from 1963, is his masterwork. His whole philosophy is in there. And I'm in awe of his gifts as a communicator, how simply he could introduce concepts. I don't have one go-to book for Joseph Murphy, because I love the man, and I would have loved to have known the man. I feel deep veneration and respect for him. I do not agree with his outlook in all instances. I wrestle with aspects of his outlook. So when I go in some of his books, there are areas where I experience deep agreement and comity with exactly what he's writing, and there are areas where I have differences, and that's true in The Power of Your Subconscious Mind. Murphy tried, I think unsuccessfully, to present an idea of why catastrophe and tragedy occurs in our world if everything is supposed to be subject to this one ultimate law of the mind, which some people today would call the law of attraction. Then why should tragedy persist or happen in places where it doesn't seem to be welcomed? And Murphy's conclusion that he came to in one of his later books was that we're all part of this one vast universal ocean of mind, and it's possible that a thought that someone came to millennia ago could reverberate and have an effect in the here and now. And I have problems with that analysis, because that almost sounds like a way of justifying or explaining away randomness. I mean, if every thought that everyone ever thought could have an effect on you or me today from 1,000 years ago, that starts to sound a lot like randomness. And I wrestle with that same question as Murphy. At the moment, I've come to a different place. If we live under one ultimate mental law, the law of mind, the law of consciousness, that may be entirely true, but I may not be able to experience that situation, that ultimate truth, in the life that I am given to live here on this plane of reality, if I can use those terms. Now, I compare it to the law of gravity. For a law to be a law, it has to be consistent. Well, the law of gravity is consistent, but you're going to experience gravity very differently here on Earth than you would if you were on the moon or on Jupiter. On the moon, you're going to experience a lightening of gravity. On Jupiter, you're going to experience a much more intense form of gravity. That's because there's more mass on Jupiter, and gravity has a greater pull. So you're also living under a different force on Jupiter, for example. You're living under the law of mass. Gravity is the same, but circumstances are different. So I think it's possible that we live under many laws and forces, and even if the law of mind is in fact the ultimate arbiter of reality, very large question obviously, and one that we can only look at through a keyhole, but if I were to grant that that's true, that doesn't mean it's the only thing that I'm going to experience in my life. Just as gravity, which is true and ultimately true, is not the only thing I'm going to experience. I experience mass. I experience a vacuum. In those circumstances, the experience of gravity is very different. So I have my differences with Murphy. I don't believe that you can trace the causality of everything, such as illness, such as death, to the mind. Our bodies are going to decay. We are going to leave these bodies, whether we want to or not, and on a schedule not of our choosing, necessarily. And that doesn't mean that people who believe in the ultimate truth of a law of attraction are wrong, but it may mean, and I think it means, that we live under many laws and forces which intervene in our experience. And this is an area with which I struggle. I haven't come to any hardened answers. So if you hear a tentativeness in my tone, that's for real. I think we have to struggle with these things. It's not going to get us as individuals anywhere, and it's not going to get us as a human community anywhere to have hardened doctrines. We have ethical guides. We've been given ethical guides in the Gospels. If we could follow those ethical guides, everything in the world would be different, but we don't seem very good at following them. But they are there. They are there. What we don't have, I believe, is a similar guide that tells us exactly what is and should be happening in terms of my relation to the ineffable, to the unseen. It's almost like that's something where the map has been withheld, where the individual has to work that out himself. So my encouragement to your listeners is work it out, experiment, try, let's work together. But Murphy sometimes settles on answers that I find unsatisfying, that I can't follow him all the way down the road with. So I love the man. I love the man. And he's given us so much. But the end of the book hasn't been written yet, so to speak. And we all need to be experimenting.
Right. Well, you know, it's good that, you know, there are certain things that may not resonate with you. Because I think that what he puts forth is really a good starting point for people to have that discussion, to be able to think for themselves and look at different perspectives. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, amen. And, you know, we have to watch out for fundamentalism within our own movements, within the New Age culture, within the New Thought culture. We get very attached to certain concepts. You know, people use the term ego all the time, where they describe inner and outer experience as if there's this clear line of demarcation between the two. And I think we have to be careful on that ground. There's also people within the New Thought culture, and I'm part of the New Thought culture, who, when faced with a challenge of a concept or something, will in effect cover their ears and say, no, I know what I know. I know how the law works. The law is perfect. I'm not interested in entertaining any ideas that are going to dilute that. I've had people all but say those very words to me and get angry at the idea of my questioning an Ernest Holmes or Joseph Murphy, even though Ernest Holmes, who was a great intellect, he wanted to be challenged. He wanted to be questioned intelligently. And we have to be very careful because it's just human nature that we in the New Age culture, in the New Thought culture, don't form catechisms of our own, doctrines of our own. It can happen, and it does happen, because it's just human nature. We need intelligent seekers who can come together in a community of belief, but can also go off on their own and experiment.
Yeah, I agree. Now, regarding positive thinking, where mm-hmm. do you think that that process falls short, you know, or where it doesn't, you know, meet the needs of, you know, of the seeker?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that New Thought and the positive mind metaphysical world have convincingly come up with a theology of suffering. I don't think it does a sufficient job of meeting people who are in suffering. If you come from one school of thought, you might say, well, everything that the sufferer is experiencing is visited from within because mind controls all. And believe me, when people at metaphysical churches who have just experienced a terrible loss hear that, it's devastating. It's the last thing that someone should hear. There's a, I think it's simply wrong. It's simply wrong. Now, there are some thinkers who I admire, very few in number, who came from this culture. I'm thinking in particular of a man named Joshua Loth-Leibman, who was a rabbi, who wrote a wonderful positive thinking book called Peace of Mind just after the Second World War. And he was one of the very few people from this culture who talked about the Holocaust and other catastrophic events. Unfortunately, he died in the late 1940s at a very young age, so he lost his voice. But one of the things he did say is that he felt that even when faced with catastrophe, if you were a survivor of that catastrophe, you had a sacred obligation to upbuild and uplift yourself to justify the loss and the sacrifice of people who came before you and people who didn't make it, and that it was infinitely, infinitely more decent and human and good to view life as a half loaf of bread if loss has cost you, than to be self-pitying or be locked into a sense of shame. That's where we need to go as positive thinkers. I use the term positive thinking because I haven't got a better one, and I want people to understand what I'm talking about. It makes it easier for me to find my community and my listeners and my collaborators. But I truly think of it as a kind of deliberative thinking, because we're trying to use the causalities of the mind. That doesn't mean that I always have to be Mr. Smiley Face, and that doesn't mean that we don't acknowledge tragedy. Positive thinking, in its truest expression, should shine a light beyond tragedy, not out of tragedy so much as beyond tragedy, nor should it obfuscate tragedy. I don't believe in directing ourselves away from the tragic. There are times of catastrophe in life, but we need to respect that part of our tools for dealing with that catastrophe do involve the causative powers of the mind. So deliberative thinking doesn't have quite the same ring as positive thinking does, and perhaps never will. So I use the older term, but that's where I think we need to go. We need to be more full, more complete, more mature in dealing with tragedy, in dealing with illness, in dealing with death, and not trying to divert people from those things, but incorporating those things as part of the human situation and saying, even as these things are incorporated, positive thinking still has something to offer without turning your face away from them.
Yeah. Now, what's your feeling about the term conscious awareness, you know, rather, you know, an awareness versus thinking? What's your feeling about that?
It's not my term. I have no problem with it. I hesitate, in all honesty, to use words like conscious or consciousness, because it's difficult to define those things, although certainly awareness is, a constructive term. I don't embrace it myself, nor am I against it. It just doesn't speak to me personally. I think of a lot of different terms that might be parallel to positive thinking, because I know people don't much like the term positive thinking. It's a term that doesn't bespeak, in the popular culture at least, or in the academic culture, in the journalistic culture, it bespeaks unseriousness. People think of positive thinking as something that's squishy, something that's soft-headed. Journalists and academics, even some of the best of them, they don't understand the prosperity gospel. They view it in this very shallow, one-dimensional way. They don't realize that, yes, there are grotesque excesses. There's no question about that. But there's other constructive congregations within the prosperity movement that play good roles in people's lives. They don't want to hear about that. A very, very fine journalist and a good guy named Jeff Charlotte recently wrote a piece in the New York Times Magazine about Donald Trump's movement and how Trump's movement was sort of like the positive thinking movement gone to hell, or the prosperity gospel movement gone to hell. And as I was reading Jeff's descriptions of Norman Vincent Peale, I thought, he's right, but he's only partly right. He doesn't have the full picture. And that's true of a lot of journalists, even the best of them, and Jeff is terrific, but they don't have the full picture because they have been raised on this automatically accepted conviction that positive thinking is woolly-headed, soft-minded, squishy. This critique goes back to H.L. Mencken, and it got reinvigorated in the 1950s when the intelligentsia loved dumping on Norman Vincent Peale. He was considered this cipher, this shallow guy, this empty suit. He was none of those things. He was a very, very deep and interesting man, and I wish I had known him. But there was this intellectual vogue in dumping on Norman Vincent Peale and dumping on positive thinking, and it's never gone away. So a lot of us get faced with this choice. Do we cut bait? Do we abandon the original terms because they're poorly received and poorly understood? Or do we hang on to them and say, bows and arrows be damned, I'm hanging on to the original? I wrestle with it. I do use the term New Age. I apply it to myself. I don't use it as a term of disrespect. I use it with veneration because I think New Age stands for something. I think that term has integrity, and I'm very aware, of course, that critics use it as an epithet. I don't. Likewise, terms like occult or ESP, those are good, serviceable terms that have a history behind them, and they sure make it plain what you're talking about, and I appreciate that. So the power of positive thinking makes it pretty plain, too. If I start to use alternate terms, people look at me funny. But if I say the power of positive thinking, they get it immediately. They get it, and there's value in that. So that's why I've hung on to it.
Great. Okay. Now, who is your favorite thinker in the world of positive thinking?
Hands down, my favorite is Neville, or Neville Goddard. Some of your listeners know him. Neville, he went by his first name. Neville was a contemporary of Joseph Murphy's. They knew one another here in New York City, actually. Neville, too, was an immigrant. He came from the West Indies, the island of Barbados, and he came to New York City when he was a very young man to study theater. And he became involved in the theater world with some success for several years. He was on the Broadway stage in the 1920s. He toured with dance troupes. He was a successful performer. But he, too, like Murphy, grew interested in the metaphysical. And by the late 1930s, more or less, he embarked on a career of his own as a metaphysical speaker and writer. And Neville is the most radical figure within the positive thinking movement because his philosophy really came down to one concrete idea, that your imagination is God, that the human imagination is the God of Scripture. And the world that you live in and everything that you experience is constantly being outpictured by your mind. And that, in fact, we live in a world, a universe of multiple and infinite possibilities, and we're not so much shaping the future as selecting it. Quantum physicists in the 1950s began to use a term called the many worlds theory to talk about the idea of different dimensions of reality. Neville was using that same idea 20 years earlier, talking about this vision of his, that a vision that he felt was absolutely borne out and proved by experience, that of his and other people, that we live in a world of infinite realities. Each of us is constantly choosing from among those realities. Everything you experience is rooted in you, as you are ultimately rooted in God. And the simple truth is, your imagination is God. And that you can bring into being anything and everything in the world because of that fact, and that ultimately, in proving that to yourself, you will commence a process, as all people do, of a kind of spiritual resurrection, rebirth, and awareness of oneself as God. Now, Neville's philosophy, which is probably the most radical expression ever to come out of the positive thinking movement, is enunciated and written about in his many, many, many books, pamphlets, lectures, with this extraordinary elegant simplicity. His argument is the kind of thing that serious people immediately would want to argue with and say, you know, wait a minute, what about this? What about that? But when you get into the experience of listening to Neville or reading Neville, you will be astonished at how persuasive and simple and elegant his ideas are. See, I wrestle with Neville because, as I was describing to you earlier, this concept of our living under this one ultimate law is one that vexes me, that troubles me, that doesn't cover all the bases. And yet at the same time, although Neville did speak in ultimate terms about all this, there is such a humanity and a decency and a beautiful symmetry to how he puts it that each time I read him, I am challenged anew. He has a way of restating his one basic thesis in terms so that it almost sounds like you're hearing it or reading it or experiencing it for the very first time. There's a constant, extraordinary freshness to what Neville does. So he, hands down, is my favorite thinker and teacher from the positive thinking tradition.
Yeah, well, great. That's perfect for our listeners to explore and get into finding out more about Neville. One of the things that you've said is that you feel that Ronald Reagan was probably the most influential positive thinker. Boy,
yes.
Tell me how that
yes.
is.
Well, Reagan was an interesting guy. People can never categorize Reagan, and he proves frustrating to his critics because it's not clear to them who is the man behind the curtain. Is there even a man behind the curtain? And his admirers, of course, want to classify him in ways so that Reagan looks like them. You know, they want to say he was a conservative Christian. He was no such thing. Reagan was a New Ager. He spent 3 decades of his adult life in the movie business in Hollywood. He proudly took on the social mores and outlook of his friends and neighbors in Southern California. He and his wife, Nancy, were New Agers. They may have been politically conservative, of course, but they were interested in numerology, tarot, astrology. Moreover, these were their friendships. One of Reagan's best friends was a guy who's been forgotten today, but he at one time was known as the Dean of American Astrology. His name was Carol Reiter, and he lived in Santa Monica. He was the first and only astrologer ever to appear on the cover of Time magazine, which he did in 1969, and he and Reagan were buddies. Reagan mentions this in his mid-1960s memoir, Where's the Rest of Me? He didn't conceal any of this. He would speak to reporters on the campaign trail openly about his friendship or relationship with psychics like Jean Dixon, his belief in clairvoyance, his belief in UFOs, which he, on at least 2 occasions, had described as having close encounters with. He spoke of having prophetic dreams. He spoke of his interest in astrology. And I found out from analyzing some of his writings and speeches that from the early days of his political career up through his presidency, in fact, he was using ideas and phrasing from the work of a cult scholar named Manly P. Hall, who wrote a book called The Secret Teachings of All Ages, which some of your viewers and listeners will have heard of. I've written about this in The Washington Post and Salon and many other places, and it's dead to rights clear that Reagan echoed certain ideas and phrases of Hall in his writing. So Reagan was much more than a guy who just enjoyed reading his newspaper horoscope over his morning coffee. There was much more going on there. And Reagan did not often speak in metaphysical terms, but sometimes he did. He was speaking in front of a conference of political conservatives, a CPAC conference in the early 1970s, and he said, "You can call it mysticism if you like, but I believe that this country has been placed here as a special gathering place for people who are persuaded of the idea that man can improve his circumstances beyond what he is told is fact." Now, that sounds a heck of a lot like Neville or Joseph Murphy, and it's not by accident. Reagan was familiar with many of these figures, and the metaphysical, positive mind metaphysics, among other things, informed his political vision, which, of course, he took in a conservative direction. Not all people from the positive thinking world, myself included, consider themselves conservatives or go in that direction. Wallace D. Wattles, who wrote the book The Science of Getting Rich, which was a big influence behind The Secret, when he was alive, he ran for national office twice on the Socialist Party ticket. He was a radical. He thought positive mind metaphysics were something that could improve the life of working people. Reagan had a similar outlook, but he viewed conservatism rather than socialism as the outward vehicle for that. Reagan was a metaphysical thinker, and Reagan probably would have enjoyed this conversation, and we probably would have enjoyed talking to him. You know, he had affection for evangelical Christians, and they for him, but he was not one of them, and anybody who says that is just living out a fantasy. That's not who Ronald Reagan was. Ronald Reagan was influenced by Christianity, and he certainly considered himself Christian, just as Joseph Murphy would have. But as we were talking about Joseph Murphy earlier, he had a lot of metaphysical views that went beyond the parameters of what is sometimes ascribed to contemporary Christianity. Likewise, Ronald Reagan. So Reagan, without attempting to ever sound like a minister or an evangelist or a metaphysician, inadvertently, he was the most prominent popularizer of positive mind metaphysics. That's the missing key that historians can't find in Reagan's career, because they don't understand the vocabulary or the reference points for which they're looking. They've been trained to regard positive thinking as nonsense. I write a lot about this in one of my books, One Simple Idea, which is a history and analysis of the positive thinking movement. In fact, that book is coming out in paperback reprint May 3rd. So anybody wants to learn more about Ronald Reagan and that background can check out my book, One Simple Idea.
Well, great. Well, that, you know, depth of Reagan. This is something that I certainly did not know. Right now, we're obviously facing in today's political environment, it seems to be a rebranding, you know, of who he was. You know, that's not really doing him a service, apparently, to the true nature
of
the man.
It's not accurate. Yeah, it's not accurate. I was at a Bernie Sanders rally last night here in New York City, and although Bernie's political program was the polar opposite of Reagan's, obviously, in terms of tone, the two men sounded a lot more like one another than do Reagan and Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a completely schismatic offshoot, I would say the same of Ted Cruz, from the Reagan form of conservatism. They, of course, want to embrace Reagan, and they make him into a secular saint. And yes, Reagan was conservative in the ways that a Ted Cruz is conservative. But there was some other different element. There was something about the man himself that instilled people with a sense of possibility. I see the same thing in Bernie Sanders. It comes from someplace within, not from a set of policies, although obviously policies are extremely important. But these guys are nothing like Ronald Reagan, just nothing like him.
Yeah, I agree, 100%. So you are one of those 27,000 that was at Bernie's thing?
Yeah, I brought my older son, Caleb, who's 11. We stood in the cold for a very long time, couldn't see a thing once we got in, but we were very glad to be here.
Great. Well, now, out of all of the things that you've read on positive thinking and practices, are there any that you use personally that you would like to share with the listeners?
For sure. One of my practices, I call it the three-step miracle. I suppose I got some of my communicative abilities from Joseph Murphy. I don't go very muted with these things. The three-step miracle is this. It comes from a little pamphlet called It Works, which was published in 1926. You must make a list of your goals and work really hard at this list. And don't fool yourself. Don't kid yourself. You've got to be brutally honest. Work on it, work on it, work on it. When you feel you have really, really gotten it right, you carry that list around with you and you read it midday, you read it morning, you read it night, you think on it as often as possible. That's step two. Step three, you tell no one what you're doing. Keep silent. This is private. This is your experiment. It doesn't belong to anybody else. It doesn't require anybody else's approval or argument. And then you just watch and wait and see what happens. And when things happen, and they will, if you do it with total commitment, they will, you express gratitude. And a lot of people would say, that's it? That's crazy. Well, it's not so crazy when it works. Try it. The key is, we so rarely, in a mature and sustained way, come in touch with what we want that we're not focusing the energies of our minds. This exercise, among other things, feeds into that. Now, if any of your listeners want to write to me, you can pop me an email. You can reach me through my website, which is just mitchhorowitz.com. I'll send them a little card that will walk them through that exercise as I just described it. It's a very simple exercise, but it demands absolute commitment. If you do it with absolute commitment, that simple exercise will prove extraordinary.
Excellent. Boy, I'm going to get that list started. As a matter of fact, I had an author on my show last week whose father passed on, and he was actually going through some of his things, and he had found in his father's wallet that exact thing, a list of goals that he had no idea about. Oh,
isn't
it was,
that wonderful?
It was. And you know, that his wishes, so to speak, were incorporated into the author's book. I mean, it was just one of those. It was really touching. So, yeah, as soon
that's
as you
remarkable.
Said that, carry it in a wallet, it's like, oh, I know all about that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really remarkable. I'm touched to hear that.
Yeah. Well, gosh, we're toward the end of the interview here. So what is Mitch working on next?
Well, as I mentioned, the paperback edition of my book, One Simple Idea, is coming out May 3rd. That's very special to me because in addition to having a history and analysis of positive thinking, I included lots of new exercises and techniques like the one that we just discussed so people can take the rubber to the road and try this out in their own lives. I'm working on a lot of audiobooks right now, a lot of articles. If people friend me on Facebook or go to Mitch Horowitz on Twitter. I stay in touch with people. I join in conversations with people, let folks know about what I'm working on. All kinds of new things are coming down the pike, and I'm trying to take it deeper and more practical in the field of positive mind metaphysics. It's my absolute commitment to come up with ways that we can all keep experimenting with these ideas.
Oh, that's great, definitely. So I'm on Facebook and Twitter, and I will be following you.
Go
I've
on
already,
Twitter.
Already sent you, sent you my friend request on Facebook, so I'm looking
right
forward
on.
To following you there.
Likewise.
Great. Well, thank you, Mitch. This has really been a fun conversation. I really thank you for your time and for joining us on to talk about your new book.
It just came out last month.
Yeah, great.
Actually, no, it's been out for a while, but it's coming out in paperback. This is One Simple Idea on May 3rd, and you'll find all kinds of things in there, all kinds of new material. Can be pre-ordered anywhere you buy books.
Perfect. Well, again, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You're welcome. Again, thank you for listening today, everyone. My very special guest has been Mitch Horowitz, and we've been talking about his newest compilation of the Joseph Murphy Treasury. It's called The Miracle Power of Your Mind, The Joseph Murphy Treasury. And again, in the show page description, I have a direct link to his book there at Amazon, so you can click on there and purchase it right away. And then, again, you can also find out more about Mitch by visiting his website, which is mitchhorowitz.com. And again, I do have a direct link to that website as well in the show page description. And be sure to follow him on Facebook and Twitter if you use those platforms. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.